I'm K2 Romeo, India Whiskey. My name is Dick. At this time, we begin the TechNet, as we do essentially every single Sunday night at 8 o'clock on this repeater, 146.85, so-called LIMARC repeater, L-I-M-A-R-C, which stands Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club for those that are out of the area. This machine does have EchoLink and IRLP connections, and therefore we hear from time to time there are a significant number of people out of the New York City tri-state area that listen to this particular repeater at certain times. As most of you have heard Sadat many times before, the main purpose of the technical net is education. The curious amateurs come together. It's a meeting of the clan in which we share information about how all of this wireless hardware that we've gathered or in the process of gathering, how does it all work? What really is radio propagation, and what's going on inside of that antenna and inside of that transmission line, and how do I make that transmitter run cooler and better, and how do I get more sensitivity out of my receiver? There's 26 or 27 different kinds of ham radio, and the 2-meter FM repeater type ham radio you're listening to right now is just one of the 26 or 27 kinds. So if for some reason ham radio doesn't seem to please you, certainly try one of the other 25 times before you give up the hobby. Arguably, it is the most educational hobby that there is, and it has to be that way, because from my point of view, the schools, when they're teaching wireless engineering, I'm talking about our fairly good electrical engineering schools, when they're teaching the wireless part, the radio part of radio engineering, of electronic engineering, they do a mediocre job at best. They're not keeping up with the technology. They're not keeping up with the times. The curriculum was set in 1947 and hasn't been changed very much since. Whereas by comparison, your computer science course, your computer engineering course, is changed and updated almost every single semester to keep it current. Modern day radio equipment is now a interesting marriage of wireless equipment plus computing equipment. You study what's going on inside of a software-defined radio. You find that it's very heavily computer-controlled, as well as you still need analog RF equipment in there. There are people who think. There are people who have, let me think now, the first time I heard it was 20 years ago, there were progressive people telling me that the very first object at the front end of a radio receiver is going to be an analog to digital converter, and the whole rest of the radio will then be digital. Interesting sounding philosophy, interesting sounding prediction. Absolutely not true. Can you digitize the IF strip? Absolutely. Can you digitize it from the front end RF? Right now the answer is no, and it's going to be for a long time. There's a bunch of technical reasons as to why. The menu that we have on the technical net is that for the first hour we take people who sign in because they've got a question or a comment for the net. So the first hour we take general ham radio questions. That's followed by John KC2WGB giving us some of the submittals he has had from the mailbag. In other words, people who don't yet have the right equipment or the right license so that they can talk to us over the air directly. They mail information to John, KC2WGB. He chooses some of those, and we review a few of those. That's followed by the space report from Paul, WS2N, who will probably be giving us a space report number 110 of the series. I guess on my part, Paul's going to correct me. And I always ask him that question, what is Voyager doing today that is the most far-flung piece of electronics that mankind has ever issued? It's something like, I think it's 13 astronomical units away from us, so something like 8 billion miles. The round-trip radio time to Voyager and back is something like 36 hours at the speed of light. Let me drop. Launched in 1977, so I guess it's something like 34, 35 years ago that piece of electronics was launched with its nuclear power supply, and it's still out there saying, this is what I see, and How are you doing down there on Earth? Quite a piece of machinery. Okay, the way a person signs into the TechNet, because they do have a question or a comment, is they give me their call letters, their name, and the word yes. A typical sign-in might be something like this, WS2N, Paul, and yes. So do we have any check-ins tonight? You need not check in, you're just listening. K2RIW listening.
36DP00 with a quickie answers.
W2RIY, Joe, yes.
Very fine. We got Joe so far, and I should have mentioned Hal quite often gives us the benefit of his many years of experience with a whole lot of electronic equipment. Joe is our first guy to sign in. Anyone else to sign in, because they do have a question or a comment, please give me your call letters and name right now.
KC2WGB with a question.
With the space report. Good evening, Dick.
Okay, I heard from both John and Paul on that last transmission. And John, were you saying you? I know you got the mail back tonight. Are you saying you've also got a technical question, John? Go ahead.
Yes, Dick, that's correct. On the subject we were speaking earlier on the phone.
Okay, Paul signed in to tell us he's ready for the space report. When we get to that menu item at approximately 9 o'clock, we don't have extreme strict adherence to that particular schedule. And so, with real questions, we've got Joe and John so far. Anyone else with a question or a comment for the technical net, give me your call letters right now and name, K2LIW.
KC2MMY, just a reminder on, I've been waiting for those potentiometer discussions. Wasn't my question, but that's a comment, KC2MMY.
Last week.
Yeah, we did have a discussion last week about potentiometers, and I've discovered there's a whole other section of potentiometers I would like to cover tonight, and we'll do a little bit of review of last week. So MMY, we'll be covering potentiometers again tonight. One last call. Anyone else to give us a question or a comment? Give me your call letters and name right now.
K2EJ.
K2EJ. Somehow I don't think you're calling in because you've got a question, but tell us what your subject matter is going to be, Eric. You got it, Eric.
Yeah, I just want to make a comment about the opening statement. Today, we actually have we'll work up to 300 and 400 megahertz. So you will need a little bit of analog circuitry in the front end to keep the stuff out that you're not interested in. You can actually digitize at the front end and do your work from there. By using a chip or an Altera chip, which is these FPGAs, they're very big, very fast. A lot of them actually look like they're ECL, although the step flies real fast, and they have built-in DSP registers, and in essence, build your own software. And the military and some other companies actually do in the 100 megahertz range. Digitized right from the front. Don't bother to do it from the IM. So yeah, it is going that way, and you'd be surprised how much time it's going to take for the speeds to double and triple. K2RIW, K2J.
I agree with you, Eric, that there's a definite trend in that area. Well, let's assume now that you and I are building a receiver for the 450 megacycle band. We'd like to look at a 20 or 50 kilohertz bandwidth region at 450 megahertz. And the weakest signal we're going to be picking up is around 0.1 microvolt, minus 120 dBm. The strongest signal we're going to pick up is probably around plus 10 dBm. So we need 130 or 140 decibels of dynamic range at a rate of 450 megahertz for the carrier. And we'd like to have an instantaneous bandwidth of 20 or 30 kilohertz while doing that. Do you believe that particular analog to digital converter is over the horizon? KE2EJ, K2LIW.
All right, well, let's define something first. Let's say minus 120 dBm without an amplifier, not happening. Okay, you would need, if you wanted to do that, you would need, you probably need, let's see, you would probably need a minimum of, to get the dynamic range that you're looking for, you probably need a minimum of 64 bits worth of word width in order to get what you're looking for, and that's not even good enough.
16PZ with a comment.
Yeah, I'll recognize, but let me go back to Eric for a second here. So you think 64 bits would be required to have that dynamic range, and would that analog-to-digital converter have a reasonable noise figure? I'm guessing it would require RF preamplification and RF pre-filtering, pre-selection filtering, which means it's not really in the front end. It's close to the front end. It's at least at the RF frequency before the first mixing down conversion, super heterodyne. But still, I think that screamer of an A to D that you just described, I think it's going to require some liquid nitrogen to keep it from melting down. That's a guess on my part. KE2EJ, KE2LAW, or a lot of parallel processing.
No, I wouldn't go with a lot of parallel processing. I mean, every A to D, every device, as much as you would like to think that it's serial, it starts off as parallel. Consider an A to D, which is simply a lattice. Okay, you put more resistors in there, you get more steps. So, let's say you have a reference voltage at the top of the ladder that's, say, a tenth of a volt. And then you build that ladder that takes you all the way down to a microvolt. That's a lot of bits. Although, you can build a DSP that's 64 bits wide, 128 bits wide, so you might consider that parallel processing, but that's not really, because that's a single word. You know, the reality of that, that's a bit off, but say, for example, the digital signal analyzer that I just bought recently, which is in the 40 grand range, it actually will do 75 megahertz worth of bandwidth straight into its A to D and do its processing from there. So it's not really that far away. Yes, you're going to need to have a little gain in the front if you're talking about microvolt, but, you know, I think we can get to the point where we don't need a gain of a million to get to where we're going. I think that, with today, some of the best stuff that's available today, for 400 megahertz, you could probably take a 200 megahertz reference oscillator and a mixer and a front end and a filter and feed that into today's A to D's, and you got yourself a system. K2RIW, K2EJ.
In order to achieve that particular RF center frequency, in order to receive that amount of instantaneous bandwidth, in order to achieve that amount of dynamic range, the total number of megabits coming out of your A to D is now a pretty big number. So therefore, the back-end computer processing is going to have to be pretty healthy to handle all of that fast-flying, very wide word. Maybe the microprocessors today are able to handle all that, but still, it strikes me as a reasonably difficult problem. What do you think, Eric? Go ahead.
All right, well, if you think speed is a problem, that's where you're going to be off. FPGAs today, some of them have measured it in multiple megaflops, hundreds, and we're even getting to thousands of megaflops at this point. Megaflops is really a measure of throughput. But the video that you watch on your TV originates as a 1.42 gigabit serial stream. And that can be either 8 or 10 bits wide. And in just about every video device that's digital, that is on the origination side, I'm not talking about the TV receiver side because things run a little slower there. We actually, since, I think, was it 92 or 93, the first SDI chips came out. And then in 96, the HD chips came out, and they run at 1.42 gigabits per second. So speed it's not necessarily a problem. And if you're doing picture manipulation like zoom and squeeze and, you know, changing its position and doing all that kind of stuff that we do normally in television, you're talking about quite a number of multiplications and additions and so on and so forth. So the arithmetic is going pretty fast. So the technology in FPGAs today is available to get you really good speeds to do really fast stuff. The only reason why I said the word would be so wide is in terms of a receiver, you know, you could have a signal that's a microvolt, a fraction of a microvolt, going all the way up to like a half a volt. And if you want to be able to work with all that, you need enough bits. K2RW, K2HR.
Repeater, mount.
No comment.
We haven't forgotten you, Hal. Hang in there. For those who are listening, the guy you just heard, Eric KE2EJ, is our local broadcast engineer for quite a few years. He was the chief engineer for both Channel 13 in New York City, the PBS channel, as well as Channel 21 out on Long Island. Another fellow who's touched an awful lot of electronics in his day is Hal, K6DPZ. So, Hal, do you feel that the analog-to-digital front-end receiver on UHF frequencies, do you feel that that one's right around the corner? K6DPZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K6DPZ. Well, here's a comment I wanted to make. You can get negative 120 dBm with a very, very hot IF without an RF stage and using a Derby balanced mixer, and you can go down there. The trick is getting the gain in the RF, not in the front end. Having some selectivity in the front end with a cavity, but getting all the gain in the back end. Because on radar equipment and everything like that, even though they're not going down to neg 120, the RF strip is pulling in all of the gain right into the diode mixer. That's my comment there. Go ahead. This is K6DPZ.
From what you just said, Hal, there's two possible interpretations. One is that you would prefer to mix down to the IF before you go into the analog-to-digital converter. Another interpretation was you could put an analog-to-digital converter in front of that front-end mixer. The A to D would really be the mixer. But you're still saying that you're fairly sure, and I'm agreeing with you on this one, that you're going to need RF preamplification and RF filtering. Because if there's a signal 300 megahertz away that's a potent one, that's a, you know, the taxi cab next door to you, so to speak, the dispatching center, then the nasty characteristic of an analog to digital converter is that if you exceed its dynamic range, if you go to the ceiling on its dynamic range, it has this nasty characteristic called wraparound, where depending on its design, it might give you a signal of zero amplitude when you really got something that's burning up the front end. K6DPZ, K2LAW.
We have a solution to that.
K6DPZ. Well, I have done certain experiments with receivers, and I use the cavity in the front into a diode mixer into IF at a high enough frequency so there would be an image. Image would be over in the next ballpark. And I was able to obtain negative 125 dBm without too much of a problem. And no RF amplification before the mixing device.
Now, you're saying you achieved minus 125 dBm. You didn't say it, but are you saying that after the mixer, the IF strip really was an analog to digital converter as the beginning of the IF strip? Is that what you're saying, Hal?
No, just in a regular linear IF. Just IF amplification. No A to D. Just a very hot IF at a high enough frequency so there wouldn't be an image coming in on the front end input. And I've got the sensitivity really down. It was an FM receiver, a matter of fact. But no RF stage. From the cavity into a diode mixer, into a high enough IF with a lot of gain, and then a discriminator, pulse counting discriminator, and it came out as quieting, and it worked very well.
Okay, you're describing an analog receiver, and the subject matter right now is digital, analog to digital converting, and the trend seems to be to move the A to D closer and closer to the front end, and that's what Eric has been telling us. KE2EJ, K2RAW, go ahead, Eric.
K2RAW, K2EJ. Alright, there's a number of different things that are going on today. You could actually have the A to D hooked literally to the antenna if, of course, you have enough, you know, fast enough sample rate and enough bits. I mean, consider an analog receiver. Receive a 1 microvolt signal, minus 120 dBm, and drive a speaker with 1 volt of output, or at least to the detector. Let's say the detector needed a volt. You need a gain of 1 million in order to get up there and turn it into reasonable levels that you can work with. If you have an HD that has enough steps or enough bits, you don't need that. Okay, and the noise factor really is going to be the aerosing noises. As far as wraparound goes, you can limit that from happening by simply using the equivalent of the center diode in the front end, and that lets the signal go over a certain level. As far as having a strong signal versus a weak signal that's somewhat near each other, with an A to D, if the sample rate is high enough and the bits are deep enough, you won't get IM products like you do in the front end.
Yeah, I agree with the spirit of what you're saying, Eric, but now I'm going to hit you with a specific. You said you need a gain of 1 million. A good receiver, almost every receiver we touch these days, has between 110 and 120 decibels of gain between the antenna connector and the loudspeaker. 110 to 120 dB of gain. A 1 million to 1 gain is what you mentioned, would only be 60 dB. So, we're way beyond that and on a typical receiver. Part of what's going on, it's not easy to understand, is that when a receiver can receive a really weak signal, a tenth of a microvolt, that comparison to a nearby transmitter, if you've got a transmitter and a receiver side by side, and you decide to run them simultaneously, even though they're on slightly different frequencies, you're asking for a huge amount of dynamic range, because that receiver that I just described, a typical receiver, is extremely easy to overload if you have something nearby that's transmitting. And many analog to digital converters, when you go beyond their maximum signal strength, they have this so-called wraparound problem. And you said there's a solution to the wraparound problem. I'm wondering what that is, Eric. KE2EJ, K2LAW.
Yeah, there's a couple different approaches. One is mathematically, and there you have to suffer with the products that are made. You get distortion. But the other method is in the analog domain. Before it hits the input of the A to D, you limit the maximum voltage that can be fed into it, so it doesn't exceed the maximum number that the register of the D to A put out.
Yeah, from my experience, what you're saying right now is right on. The receiver that I worked on, the defensive receiver on the B-1 bomber, B-1B bomber, in order to know when its downrange analog to digital converters were being potentially overloaded, there was a directional couple with a crystal detector right at each and every antenna port, and I think there was something like 27 antennas. So every one of them had its own crystal detector at the front end, letting you know that if the voltage coming out of the crystal detector was above a certain number of volts, you knew that everything that came out downrange was suspicious. It could be full of birdies and phony digital components that are not real. And you knew that the logic of the system then knew it had to throw in electronically controlled attenuation, digitally controlled attenuation, in order to limit the signal level going downrange. Okay. We normally take things in order. Poor old Joe has been bypassed quite a bit here. He's the first guy who signed in with a real question. W2RYY, a patient guy on the South Shore who does television DXing. K2RAW, you got it, Joe.
My question is on antennas, and if you don't have an antenna, you're sunk. You can't do anything unless you got an antenna coming in, right, Dick? Here's the question, and it goes something like this. The lower you go in frequency, the higher the Q of the antenna inherently. It seems to be a hard thing to get around, so your bandwidth decreases. Here's my question relating to this subject. If you wanted to make a antenna work on a rather wider than normal bandwidth using something resembling a dipole type of construction, and let's take 160 meters for example, because it's a pretty tough band to be able to work up and down by any significant amount because of the inherent bandwidth. You quickly go out of the return loss specs of the antenna that you'd like to see, like approaching 10, minus 10. It's very easy to approach that pretty quickly, going away from your center frequency. You had talked a while ago about overlaying one antenna on top of another, maybe to be able to create a multi-band dipole. And the theory was that one antenna would not affect another one. Can you do the same thing on a band, like 160 meters, and say if you had one dipole constructed to have a resonant frequency all by itself of, say, 1850 kilohertz. And then you take the second dipole, you got to overlay that, and it has a resonant frequency by itself of, say, like about, 1900 kilohertz. Now you're going to a spread of 50 kilohertz there. Now, somewhere in the middle, you're not going to get the best return loss. It's going to go maybe slightly up, or would actually do something even more strange than that. But would something like this kind of constructed antenna, give you a wider than normal bandwidth, and what do you think about the performance of it? Back to you, Dick.
36DPZ with a comment.
Yeah, maybe you've already done this, Hal. I've got a bunch of opinions on this, but let's see. Well, from your experience, have you actually built super broadband 160 meter or 80 meter dipole like structures? K6DPZ, K2LIW.
Now, I experiment with that on the West Coast. My suggestion is building a birdcage antenna. Each element on your dipole, make it as a birdcage structure with multiple elements. That will give you a very broad bandwidth. Rick, I think you're familiar with the birdcage configuration, aren't you?
Oh, absolutely. If you find the right picture, and I can't remember where I saw it, of the dipole antenna for 80 meters that's present on the top of the tower at American Radio Relay League, ARRL headquarters in Newington, Connecticut, it is a birdcage antenna. And that birdcage antenna, it looks to me like the four wires of the birdcage of this 80-meter dipole look like they're spread about a foot, maybe 8 inches, in that order. Now, I've done a lot of experimenting with very broadband dipole and Yagi-like antennas, where I got extreme bandwidth and got patents on it. I did this at 915 megacycles. At 915 megacycles, if you make a dipole, which normally is around 4.5 inches long, if you make it 3/4 of an inch or 1 inch wide out of copper tape laid out on a piece of clear plastic, so to speak, boy, you can get some fantastic bandwidth. Let me drop it. And one of the friendliest characteristics of all antennas is they will give you the exact same performance if you scale every single dimension proportion to wavelength. In other words, if I took that 915 megacycle antenna, which has got 3% bandwidth, and my definition of bandwidth is where the VSWR does not exceed 1.05 to 1, from 902 to 928 megacycles, across 26 megs of bandwidth, 3 megs of bandwidth. It's got that extremely low standing wave ratio. If you allow me to make 3/4 inch wide elements out of sheet metal, now because I know that every characteristic of an antenna can be scaled to a longer bandwidth, lower frequency, by scaling every one of the dimensions, if I built that dipole at 80 meters out of the birdcage, the birdcage would be something like 25 to 30 feet in diameter. That's getting a little bit ridiculous. Possible, but you're going to have to be very enthusiastic to build a dipole. If this is the best of all worlds, you'd build it out of 30-foot diameter tubing and 132 feet long. Very few of us are going to do that. By way of the birdcage technique, you've got wires that are suspended in a circular pattern. When you look down the dipole, down the end of it, you can fool the RF into thinking that most of that diameter is really there. Let me drop. antenna that I'm familiar with that works so extremely well at 915 megacycles. If I could scale it to 80 meters and 160 meters, boy, it would be gangbusters. It'd be the best thing since baked bread, if you know what I mean. However, for physical constraint reasons, we're not going to do that. What Joe is advocating, and I think he's right, if we took the fan dipole characteristic, where if you build a dipole at 80, 40, 20, 15, and 10, and you lay them all side by side, so to speak, and bring them together at one common point, feed them with one common transmission line, with a ballon, hopefully, you'll get beautiful standing wave ratio in the middle of each one of those bands. Now, what Joe is advocating is that instead of stacking these fan dipoles, multiple dipoles, where they are essentially an octave apart, he wants to put them a few percent apart. And would that work? And the answer is yes. Let me drop.
But, Dick, to qualify that, I'm talking about per band. Per band.
And I'm talking about per band. Per band. I'm going to let you build a dipole at 1850 alongside of a dipole at 1875 alongside of a dipole at 1900 alongside of a dipole at 1950, so to speak. If you did that, would you get very good standing wave ratio across that frequency region? The answer is essentially yes. It's a little bit more complicated. There's going to be a little bit more interaction between those dipoles. And one of your questions was, in between those frequencies, what's going to happen? Well, when you're above the resonant frequency on one of those dipoles, it presents itself as an inductor. When you're below the resonant frequency of the adjacent dipole, it presents itself as a capacitor. The capacitor in shunt with the inductor gives you a very high impedance, and still, are you still going to get the switching action? Let me explain switching action. When you build a fan dipole for 80, 40, 20, 15, and 10, for instance, and when you're transmitting, let me pick a number, 40 meters, 99% of your energy coming out of your transmitter, going down that feed line at 40 meters, is going to go into the 40-meter dipole, because that dipole is giving you a 72 ohm impedance, and therefore it absorbs all the energy. The 80-meter dipole is presenting 1,500 ohms. It's almost an open circuit. The 20-meter dipole is presenting 1,500 ohms. It's almost an open circuit. The RF energy will flow down the circuit that has the right impedance, the right dipole, so you get automatic switching in the case of a fan dipole on octavely spread bands. And now, when you get the same switching action, when you've got all of these dipoles very closely spaced within one particular band, and I'm reasonably convinced the answer is yes, there's going to be a couple of funny characteristics. When you plot the gain indoor visua of that antenna, and if you've got five individual dipoles, let me drop. You have five individual dipoles scanning the low end to the high end of 160 meters, for instance. You're now going to get a slightly bumpy curve of visua versus frequency. I'm reasonably convinced you can keep that curve well under 2-to-1 visua across that band if you stack enough of those wires. I'm very disappointed that I haven't seen that antenna that Joe and I are now describing. I don't remember seeing it in any of the good antenna books. Maybe somebody out there is going to tell us, yes, they've seen that, and yes, this part of it works well, and this part of it is not so good. But I think it's an extremely a good theory experiment to go and try, Joe. I give you a high probability of success, and even if you get some glitches in the beginning, I think there's going to be ways around the glitch. The basic structure has got the bandwidth. Because if you think about it, let me drop. Both John and I and you, in our early days of television, installed a kind of antenna which was called a double conical television receiving aerial. So that when you build something that looks like a bow tie-like antenna, and if you had the resources to build it out of one solid sheet of metal, boy, would it have fantastic bandwidth. You recognize the bow tie that wears the driven element on UHF parabolic dish antennas that were popular 10, 20 years ago. It had a lot of bandwidth to it. And now a skeleton structure where it's made out of individual wires that have individual frequencies across one particular band. I give you a 90% chance that's going to work like a charm. I think it's worth it. drag your feet on this one, Joe. When I pass it back to you, there's a possibility somebody out there has already tried this, or he knows of an article that gives us some more real information of someone who's done it. W-H-2-R-Y-Y with some delay. K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
K-2-R-I-J with a comment.
Eric recognized, out of curiosity, if there's anybody else. Okay. I wonder if you've actually done it, Eric. K-E-2-E-J, or know somebody who has. K-2-R-I-W, you got it, Eric.
K-2-R-I-W, K-E-2-E-J. Well, when I had the hazard destroyer, I built a couple of fan dipoles that booked on 80 and 40, and pretty much kept my visual pretty much under 1.7, I think it was, 1.6 to 1. It was pretty good across both bands. But interestingly enough, in this month's QST, there's an article about Titan missile base in Arizona or Colorado. I think it's Arizona, south of Phoenix. It's a museum, and they have one of the original disc cones that was used for communication, you know, for nuclear missile silos. And they actually have a little box and a picnic table for you to bring your rig and plug into that antenna if you read that article. It's very interesting. They did very well with the real QRP power, but just a comment. K2RIW, K3J.
And the main reason why our government, during the days of Titan and other surface-to-surface missiles, intercontinental missile type things, they used that disc cone antenna, which, by the way, was not built out of sheet metal like you and I would do it on, say, for instance, a UHF frequency. It was built out of a zillion individual pieces of wire. It was a cage structure that presented a disc cone, where there really was a bottom disc and a cone above it made out of a zillion wires. That gives them a lot of bandwidth. That's what they wanted, instantaneous bandwidth. They didn't want an antenna that had to be retuned every time they hopped to a new frequency. And some of the classified transmitters and receivers that were using those these were using the Singar's technique of frequency hopping in order to not know the next few milliseconds what frequency you're going to be on, so that nobody could jam you and know what you're transmitting and not receive it all, if you know what I mean. If you didn't have a priori knowledge as to what the pseudo-random code of the next frequency of transmission was going to be, then receiving that signal was extremely difficult. Works like a charm. Let me drop it. And yes, if Joe was willing to fill up his yard with wire, he could rebuild that structure. And it's not super expensive, but it's still pretty elaborate. Considering the fact that he's not trying to cover the multiple octaves of continuous frequency, the reason why they used that disc cone, the good news about the disc cone is that that thing probably worked from, I'm going to choose a number, 3 megacycles to 60 megacycles inclusive. Every one of those frequencies in between, that structure could probably do that. But it's still a very elaborate structure. Since Joe right now is talking about one band at a time, 80 meters, a fan dipole where the individual elements of the dipole cover individual favorite frequencies evenly distributed across 160 meters, I think that's going to work. I wonder, Joe, I'm not sure you've got a piece of property big enough to do it. However, let me drop. You will sacrifice some of the bandwidth if you mechanically shrink those individual dipoles. If your piece of property is not 260 feet long, so you can build a real full-size dipole on 160 meters. And you start using loading coils, zigzagging top hat capacitors, and an antenna tuner, you can do it. But each individual dipole now, when you mechanically shrink them, the Q goes up and the bandwidth goes down. So therefore, putting up enough individual dipoles that are mechanically shrunk is now going to get a little bit difficult, but still doable, in my opinion. And by the way, when you said that the natural characteristic of antennas is to go up in Q when you go down in frequency, let me drop. When you said that, Joe, you are accurate with typical practices, but it's not theory. if I was taking my favorite antenna on any frequency, 432 megacycles, and I scaled every single dimension and built an equivalent on 2 meters, and then built an equivalent on 6 meters, and then built an equivalent on 10 meters, and then built an equivalent on 160 meters, the Q would be identical. For a bunch of mechanical reasons, because of the way we build antennas, when you get down to the very low frequencies, where the wavelengths are huge, and therefore you tend to use a piece of 14-gauge household wire that's 260 feet long, because you've made the wavelengths of diameter of the radiator smaller and smaller in wavelengths, we've changed the mechanical scaling, and therefore the Q goes up. So you're absolutely right, but not for the obvious reason. It's not the theory of antennas that's causing it. It's the way we implement them. W2RYY, not an interesting set of questions. K2RYW, go ahead, Joe.
No, I try to keep you thinking. Well, see, the 160-meter antenna question was really not meant for me. It was actually meant for somebody else, but he never wants to come on here and take his time to talk to you on the TechNet. But he had somebody else take his 160-meter dipole apart. That was stretched out semi-horizontally, and the guy made an L, what's called an L, or he called it an L. One horizontal element and one vertical element. And the vertical element he stretched about, I'd say about 10 feet from the tower, and running the height of the tower. He got it to resonate on a frequency, but it caused all sorts of electronic mischief with the electronics coming down the tower, like tower rotor control and other various electronics on the tower that has to do with the tower lowering and high wind speed. Of course, everything just to get totally upset by running, like even a couple hundred watts just screws everything up. And I told him, not a good idea. You can't do that kind of stuff. So it's like back to the drawing board as far as that goes. He tried to simulate a 160-meter vertical antenna, but that didn't work so well. So I'm going to give the guy some ideas, because I know it on 160 meters, 80 meters is a little more forgiving. Right, I should have qualified that question, but I do understand what you're saying with me. If you scale everything the same, everything should be the same following it going down and on because of frequencies and so forth. I understand that. But in practicality, we can't have what you're saying would be we'd have a couple of foot diameter elements on these low band antennas. Even doing something on 40 meters would be quite ridiculous, trying to get the bandwidth out of it by doing like what you said. So we all have to live with running with thin tubing for a beam, or thin wire for a dipole antenna. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, one of the other things that it's hard to realize is that when you're running a kilowatt, I should do the calculation, the exact number of RF volts you're putting into a antenna. When you're running a 1,000-watt transmitter, it's something in the vicinity of 350, 400 volts RMS, big voltage, and almost every antenna you and I are going to touch has a Q of at least 10. Q of 10 means that the voltage rises by a 10-to-1 ratio, and somewhere else in the antenna the current rises by a 10-to-1 ratio. So if you're putting, let me pick a number, 400 volts into the antenna, it's got a Q of 10, somewhere in that antenna is 4,000 volts flying around. You put that alongside of your cabling going up a tower, and you're only a foot away from it, you're going to couple all kinds of signals into it, and your rotator is going to be unhappy, and your line driver preamplifiers on your VHF, UHF antennas, they're going to become unhappy. That is a livable situation if you understand the rules of shielding. If you're willing to take the cabling that goes into your rotator and shield the living daylights out of it, and the same thing with the cabling that goes to your preamplifier. There are ways of doing that. I didn't say it's easy, but it can be done. With good shielding techniques, you can get 110, maybe even 120 decibels of isolation between object A and object B, even though they're a couple of feet apart, if you use all of the state-of-the-art shielding techniques. Let me drop. But none of us run shielded multi-conductor cable up to our rotator. If you're willing to spend the dollars, though, and buy the right kind of cable, you'll make a huge improvement along those lines. And therefore, the azimuth indication of your rotator will go haywire, and the indexing won't go haywire, if you know what I mean, if you're properly shielded. And now, there's nothing magic about the antenna going up the side of the tower staying perfectly parallel to the tower. It could be a sloper, where major portions of the antenna slant away from the tower, and that will also help. So there's ways around this. So what's your guess, Joe? Do you think your friend who's going to be building a 160-meter antenna has the real estate and the enthusiasm to make a fan dipole with the individual elements of the fan attuned to 1850, 1875, 1900, 1925, and so on? Do you think he has the enthusiasm to try it? Because if he did, I know whether it's a success, let me drop. Whether it's a success or a failure, and I think it's a high probability done correctly, it will be a success. It'll make a beautiful article. It'll give you a lot of information about antenna theory as to what's going on. And with some difficulty, I believe that our NEC programs, numeric electronic code, mini NEC and so on, these antenna modeling programs, I think can handle this. It's getting a little bit elaborate, and so let me think about that. What the NEC does is it takes your antenna and breaks it into a whole bunch of tiny little sub-elements, finite elements. But now when you've got so darn many individual dipoles, and therefore the number of finite elements with individual tuning is going to be such a large number, I'm a little bit afraid that NEC might give you an answer that starts drifting pretty far from reality. It's worth a try. So if you think your friend has the resources to go and do this, I think it's definitely worth an attempt, Joe. To B2LYY, keep us posted on this one. K2LYWTechNet. You got a joke?
Well, my friend in amateur radio is the same guy that you know in amateur radio. We both know the same guy. And he does things like coming up with consequences and then worry about the consequences later, like what I've just discussed with you. So, yes, he has enough real estate to play this kind of game. Whether he's enthusiastic enough to be able to do what I suggest to him that will let him work a wider variety of frequencies, that I don't know. I can make a suggestion, does it, and it works out fine. I'll bring that back to details, and I'll let you know.
Okay, looking forward to that. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, just listening to this conversation reminds me of something that I didn't have the space to do, but I wanted to try many years ago, and that was to basically take two fiberglass pulleys on a fiberglass shaft that's connected to a motor that goes in either direction, and you would take two trees and hook two pulleys onto it with two weights, and you would actually, it's just kind of like a step IR. When I saw that, I said, gee, I had that idea years ago. Whereas essentially you adjust the length of the dipole according to the frequency you chose.
Yeah, that stepper IR antenna, where there's versions of it with three or four element Yagis on 40 meters, 20 meters, 10 meters, and so on, where it can tune the individual elements, and you can literally make the Yagi flip what direction. In other words, if the Yagi is mechanically aimed north, and ordinarily it sends the signal north, you can tell those little stepper motors in there to retune the driven elements, the reflector, and the director, and so tune them in the opposite direction so that what used to be a director becomes a reflector and so on, and therefore the antenna that's mechanically aimed north now will fire south, and it only takes you a few seconds to grind this motor and go to the new position. And so with your pulley technique, driven with the right kind of a servo motor, within some number of seconds or a good fraction of a minute, you can do that. The method that Joe is now discussing, though, you'll have that bandwidth instantaneously. In fact, you could, in theory, even send slow scan television on that 160-meter antenna because of instantaneous bandwidth. So there's pros and cons. You got to invest with some more antenna wire up in the air, some more hardware to get this instantaneous bandwidth. But because wire is not that expensive, and most people that are your neighbors, let me drop it. Within reason, your neighbors do not see wire in the air. Obvious by the fact that they live in communities for the last zillion years where every 150 feet down every single street, you've got utility poles with zillions of wires on every one of those poles. They've been there forever. Nobody even sees them anymore. They don't complain about them, even though they're a huge hazard. A significant number of people die every year because their automobile strikes one of those things. And in some of the streets that I drive near, some of those utility poles are 1 foot off the edge of the road. Why in the world somebody would allow a utility pole to be mounted in that location? It's just out of sight. Somebody is very short-sighted as to the number of people that are going to die because their automobile is going to strike that darn thing. But what I'm getting at is people do not see wire. Yagi antennas and bigger structures and parabolic dishes and horns, yeah, they see that. But wire, you can get away with murder. So, and the automatic switching technique of a fan dipole is so simple and yet so effective, I think it's the right way to go. And you may have to taper them in a funny way. In other words, the individual dipoles are going to see some capacitive coupling of the adjacent dipoles. And therefore, after you on paper select a dipole for each of those frequencies I mentioned, when you actually go and build it, because of the capacitive coupling between them, they may all end up a little bit lower than you expected, and you have to readjust them. But that's not a showstopper. Let me drop. So I'm looking forward to you and my friend actually doing that and keeping us posted. Thank you, Joe. See you down the line. And John, KC2WGB, right after John, I'm going to give you guys a little bit more information about potentiometers. I suddenly realize there's a whole section on potentiometers that we didn't cover last week, and we'll do a little bit of review of last week. KC2WGB, the man with the mailbag, K2LAW TechNet. You got it, John.
KC2WGB, yes, with my own question in my own mailbag. Very good. We were speaking earlier about a piece of wire, a meter long, and it was a 50-ohm piece of coax, double-shielded. And we determined that the reading by the manufacturer of 6 dB per 100 was conservative, and it calculates to 4. My question is, which I forgot to ask you earlier, was as I lower the frequency from 500 megahertz to 250, what should be the rate of fall on the attenuation of that cable, Dick, if you could give me a little bit on that? Back to you.
There's a very handy set of rules of thumb on that. A number of computer programs will model for you the insertion loss of coax cable, where you only know it at one particular frequency, and the program will calculate for you what it does at other frequencies. And it's the square root frequency phenomenon. The insertion loss of coax cable changes as the square root of frequency. If you went from frequency A to frequency B, and those two frequencies were a 4-to-1 ratio, and the square root of 4 is 2, therefore your insertion loss would change by 2-to-1. If it was really 4 dB of loss per 100 feet at 500 megacycles, and you went to 1/4 of that frequency, 125 megacycles, I think it is, or something like that, you would measure exactly half the number of decibels. By the way, that formula works in decibels, one of the very few formulas that does. Rarely do you take ratios and then multiply the decibels by that ratio, but in this case it does. So that formula works extremely well. So therefore, as long as somebody can give you one point, you could predict almost all other points with that square root formula. There's a slight catch, and that is, as you get near the upper limit of the cable, almost every cable, let me drop this, has an upper frequency limit where the manufacturer no longer guarantees the performance up there for two very good reasons. Number one, you take, for instance, this particular cable you and I are now discussing, something like RG214, RG9, these are the double-shielded coax cables of the approximate diameter of RG8 cable. They have an upper frequency limit, I think it's in the vicinity of 5 or 10 gigahertz, where the outer conductor of the cable starts acting like a round piece of waveguide, and some of the RF signal says, I don't give a darn about following your center conductor anymore. I'm going to start going down this cable in the waveguide mode, and the heck with your center conductor. And as such, you've now got two different modes of the signal going down the cable, the waveguide mode and the coaxial mode. They have two very different velocities of propagation. Therefore, those two modes, when they get to the other end of the cable, at certain frequencies, they're in phase with each other, at certain frequencies, they're out of phase. depending on how far you're sweeping the frequency and how many wavelengths of cable you've got in use. And therefore, you end up with some really big ripple of insertion loss of the cable. That's not a showstopper. It's a predictable phenomenon. Let me drop it. There are a number of ham radio operators who chose their favorite piece of cable, which might be a 7/8 inch air-filled Andrew hardline cable. I don't know the exact number, but maybe the manufacturer tells you don't go above 1,000 megahertz. And the guy wanted to use it at 3 gigs or 5 gigs ham band. And because the manufacturer said it didn't go there, the guy wouldn't go there for fear that the cable would explode, catch on fire, and do terrible things. Well, as long as you as an amateur radio operator have got a little bit more smarts, as long as you're trying to do a narrow band operation, in other words, when you're on the 2304 band, there's an exact megacycle we go to, 10.368 gigahertz. These are exact frequencies we all go to, plus or minus a few KC, so to speak. Very narrow band operation. Therefore, you're willing to tune the length of the cable, the tuning of the cable, or whatever, so that those two different modes of operation come out in phase with each other. Therefore, the overall cable insertion loss at that frequency will go down. So there's some interesting tricks you can play. So what I was starting to get to, though, is that as you go near the upper limit of the manufacturer's characteristic, that formula of square root is only a resistive loss formula. Let me drop it. And when a manufacturer designs cable and he decides what brand name and what exact model number of dielectric material he's going to use between the center conductor and the outer conductor, the particular material he chose usually starts developing extra dielectric loss above or near that upper recommended cutoff frequency. So therefore, as you start going near the upper cutoff frequency, you get two loss phenomena happening simultaneously. The square root formula, which is the resistive loss, combined with the dielectric loss, which is a more linear formula. Therefore, when you look at any of the curves in the good books like the Radio Amateur's Handbook or the Antenna Book, where there's a page showing you a whole bunch of cables as a graph, where the horizontal dimension is frequency, the vertical dimension is logarithmically displayed at decibels, and most of those cables have a straight line of almost a 45 degree angle on that graph. But you'll notice that the upper end of each one of those cables suddenly hooks upward. That's where the resistive loss starts combining with the dielectric loss, and now you're getting a higher slope of loss versus frequency because of these combined phenomena. So as long as you're not very close to that upper cutoff frequency, the square root formula that I just gave you, it'll give you 95% accuracy most of the time, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the Tech Man.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. I was just wondering, because the reason I asked, I thought there would be a formula for that. If I go right now, I'm measuring 800.08 loss per meter. Now, if I have that frequency down to 250 or below, it gets to the point where I can't make a reliable measurement on the loss. So that's why I was asking. Okay, back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
If it was 0.8 or 0.08, and I take the square root of a 2-to-1 ratio, which is 1.414, and divide, you now go to 0.056. So the 0.08 becomes 0.056. So it's quite predictable. Yes, measuring insertion losses that low, let me think about that. How would I do that? Your amplitude resolution on most of your things like vector network analyzer and spectrum analyzer, some of them will have a mode you can select on the screen where instead of it being 10 dB per centimeter and 5 dB per centimeter, some of them will have a switch function where you can go to 1 decibel per centimeter. With careful calibration, you may be able to resolve it, resolve the kind of losses you're talking about. The other approach, let me think about this now, you could double the loss by using the cable twice. By that I mean put a known very high quality short circuit device at the end of the cable. Now at the input end of the cable, you measure standing wave ratio. In order for that standing wave ratio measurement to take place, let me drop. The signal has to go down the cable once, hit the short circuit at the end, reflect back, and come through the cable a second time. So now the insertion loss of the measurement doubles, therefore you start getting a little bit more resolution. You've got to worry a little bit about the quality of your short circuit device. Is it making real good contact?